Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Susan Estrich. Estrich is a professor of law and political science at the University of Southern California Law School. She is a regular commentator for Fox News and is the author of several books, including The Case for Hillary Clinton and the recently published Soulless, Ann Coulter and the Right-Wing Church of Hate. Both books were published by Regan Books, which is an imprint of HarperCollins. I'm talking to Susan Estrich from her home in Santa Monica, California. Susan Estrich, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Listen, I want to start with the fact that law and politics don't always walk hand in hand. So I was wondering which came first for you. Did you start out as a political activist and decide to go into law, or were you always passionate about both?
They went hand in hand for me, but that's probably a reflection of how old I am. that I grew up with the 60s and the 70s when my whole idea of going to law school was to change the world. And I guess you might say I'm still trying.
Mm.
You know, the world keeps changing and I keep trying.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've always seen law as a... And I continue, I've been teaching law for 27 years now. I continue to see law as a tool, as a weapon, as an incredible resource. I mean, if you look around the world, you can see that it's a heck of a lot easier for people to figure out how to go to war with each other than to figure out how to create systems whereby they can live together peacefully. And that's how I think about law. The system of law, the rule of law, creating constitutions, creating systems by which people can live in peace takes a lot of work.
Yeah, I agree with you. Now, I don't suppose you knew when you were first pursuing your goals that your biography would be filled with all these firsts. You're the first woman president of Harvard Law Review, the first woman to run a presidential campaign. Did you set out to break barriers, or was this just you doing your thing?
It was sort of inevitable at my age. I mean, I think when I started out, there just weren't women doing any of the things I wanted to do. If you looked ahead, you just couldn't find women in those positions. I mean, when I got to law school, there were no women on the faculty.
Mm.
When I got into politics, I jokingly was explaining to my students that back in the first presidential campaign I worked in back in 1979, I was basically one of the senior women in the campaign. I was all of about 25 years old. But that's because up until that point, women hadn't had very senior roles in campaigns. I mean, they just weren't any.
Mm-hmm.
And what depresses me now is not that I collected first. I mean, I'm 50 years old. That's okay. You know, somebody had to be first. It was fine that it was me or somebody else, you know, somebody. It's that so many of the women who went first haven't been helping women to come after them. And
yeah.
That's really frustrating me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I hate watching and seeing women who went first or second or third turn their back on other women.
Yeah, and just say, I got mine, and now you guys have to work to, you know, without any help from me, yeah.
Yeah, and
I notice that attitude.
Students tell these stories every day of watching and living through this experience of not even wanting women as mentors, because they look at women in my generation and see them, frankly, as hostile.
Mm-hmm.
They don't think they're going to be supportive of younger women. And in too many cases, they're right.
Yeah.
And I think what was supposed to happen was that women my age were supposed to get up there, change the rules, and make things easier for the women of the next generation. What's in fact happened is it was much too hard to get to the top. Very few women did. And of the ones who did, far too many developed what I call only woman in the room syndrome,
yeah.
Where they wanted to be the only one there.
Exactly. Yep, I've seen that all over the place as well. I call it the queen bee syndrome, don't
it's
you?
Exactly,
yeah.
What it is.
Yeah.
And the result of it is that we don't have women's voices. That, you know, a girlfriend of mine sent me a clipping the other day saying that assignments for women are down 40%. Since Katie Couric took over the CBS Evening News.
Oh.
I mean, what a disaster that is.
It is.
To think that, you know, you've got one woman anchor and the assignments for women are going down. I mean, it's just terrible.
It is unbelievable. It really is. Now, you know what else I want to talk about? I want to talk about the book you published about a year ago called The Case for Hillary Clinton, speaking of women rising to the top. Now, it was published before her overwhelming reelection in the, in the
New
York Senate
race. Well, I kind of predicted that, have to say. That wasn't a toughie to predict.
That wasn't, no. Here in New York, we knew she had it in the bag.
Right. I mean, I think anyone could predict that one. Now, the next one is a little harder to predict. It's interesting because in New York, you have a different view of her, obviously, than the country does. There was just a Quinnipiac survey that came out, I think, 2 days ago on likability. And, of course, what it showed was that on every measure, with every group except women, I should say, her husband is much less hated, much better liked, I guess, than she is, even though the big thing she did wrong in her life, of course, was standing by him.
A lot of people are angry about that, aren't they, Susan? It's unbelievable.
No, it's a very ironic thing. If you ask people, what is it that you don't like about her? What is the thing that makes you dislike her most? It's her decision to stay with him. On the other hand, it's because he cheated that they don't like her, and they punish her, not him. I mean, if ever life was unfair for women, I got to tell you, it's that particular conundrum. And what I find really interesting, in fact, is that she's such a Rorschach test in the sense that I actually know the person. So I can tell you that the person doesn't have all that much to do with the public image. But the public image people have of her is such a reflection of how different people construct their image of an ambitious, powerful woman.
Mm-hmm.
That in some respects we're all on the line when Hillary's on the line. And by we, I mean all of us who wear black suits once in a while. because we're all being judged whether we like it or not. If she goes down, people won't say, oh, it's a particular judgment about a particular woman. They'll say, well, it was a rejection of a certain type.
Well, it's a hard line that a woman in power like she is has to walk, right? Because I've seen her in person, and she does appear much softer. But it's impossible to do that if you're going to be running for office. You have to, you have to be tough and so on.
And if you're a woman and you're not tough, you're toast. I mean, imagine running for president at a time when national security and terror are the number one issues, and seeming soft. I mean, you would be absolute toast. So, you have to walk, as you put it rightly, this incredibly fine line. Because if you're not perceived as Maggie Thatcher tough, you're toast.
Mm-hmm.
But if you walk too far over that line, you're not feminine enough. And, if you're married to Bill Clinton, that makes it particularly tricky because he's not the easiest guy in the world to figure out how to maneuver next to, I mean, you can be a great speaker, but next to him, you're going to sound like a monotone.
Yeah, and we saw that happen at Coretta Scott King's funeral.
She's constantly going to be compared to him.
She was criticized because of that, yeah.
On the one hand, she's got at her disposal the greatest political mind on the face of the globe, which is a tremendous asset.
I agree, yep.
On the other hand, were she just a woman senator, we'd all be saying, my God, she's this, she's so brilliant, look at this amazing re-election, look at these numbers. As it is, people forever compare her to him and, say she's not as this as him and she's not as that as him and she's not as charismatic as him and she's not as this as him.
Yeah.
Nobody is. I've never met a soul in my life who is. So that can't be the standard.
Yeah, but let's talk about the fact of her support for the war, which is incredibly problematic for many of us.
Certainly, for me too.
Discuss that. How is she going to maneuver around that?
Well, I think by the time the Iowa caucuses roll around, no one but maybe Laura and the dogs are going to be supporting the war. I think what has happened, sadly, it's one of those where should we be happy that we were right?
No.
But we were.
I know,
and
I agree.
And we are every day being proven more right. And the ridiculousness of what we are into and the, I mean, Hillary is going to have to be out of her position, and everybody will have to be in the same position by the time we get to the Iowa caucus, because any other position is increasingly becoming untenable. What are you supporting? Civil war? Mm. I mean, one of the things that's becoming interesting to me about John McCain is that in calling for more troops, I think he's forcing some people who had been in this romantic idea of him as a moderate to take a second look and say, wait a minute, who is this guy?
Yeah, exactly. You know? I've actually heard people say that. So it's good that he's revealed himself.
Well, it's very good, because now they're going to have to realize that he's, you know, anti-choice and not very tolerant and, you know, conservative. I mean, he's a perfectly nice guy. I've met him. I enjoy him. I mean, I think he's, compared to a lot of Republicans, much more honest and has more integrity and all of that. But the fact of the matter is, he's way too conservative for most of the people who've talked about voting for him.
Mm-hmm. And are you afraid at all that Hillary will come out as too moderate? Because she's already got so many people angry with her on the left. You know,
one of two things is going to happen. I think either, you know, I think Barack Obama is going to run against her.
And do you really?
Yeah, I really do. Look, I look at who he's talking to in Iowa, and to me, it looks to me like, you know, this is a guy who's exploring his options. And as he explores his options are going to look really good. Mm. You know? I know what he's going to see.
I've been rather fond of the thought of him being on the ticket with her myself, but I suppose that's too much to dream
of. That's too much to ask for. So I think he's going to run against her, because I think everything he's going to hear and see is going to say to him, this is the year and this is the time, and magic doesn't happen. I mean, I've had these conversations with Bill Clinton when he went through this. And, you know, you don't wait for the moment when it's right for you. You go with the moment when it's right in the time, mm-hmm. if you know what I mean.
I do.
And this is the moment when it's right in the times. And so he's going to go, and one of two things will happen for Hillary. Either she'll beat him, in which case she'll emerge as a much stronger candidate for having done so, because her experience will count for something, and people will think of her as better, and she'll get a second look from everybody. Or she won't, in which case the party will be better off, because we shouldn't nominate someone who can't win.
Yeah, yeah. But I think a lot of people in the country are going to be looking for a leader who's decisive and articulate, and certainly she would fit the bill there. So, you know, I think it'll be an interesting presidential election. Yeah.
It will be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
We will live in interesting times. Anything with Hillary involved is sure to be interesting. And the right goes berserk, so it'll be interesting.
Yes,
and a woman and a black running, I mean, interesting it will be.
Yeah. Now, along these lines of women in power, let's talk about your recently published book called Soulless, Ann Coulter, and the Right-Wing Church of
Coulter.
Hate.
And
please
going
tell,
over the line.
But tell me why you wanted to give Coulter more publicity. I'm sure you've been asked this before.
Well, because I do believe that it wasn't about giving her more publicity. It was about taking her down and forcing people. You know, I'm from the school of thought that says you have to fight back. You know, Willie Horton and the Swift Boats teach the lesson that you don't ignore things. They don't go away by ignoring them.
Oh, that's a good reason for having done this. I hadn't thought of...
You know, I've been with the guys who said this is, you know, ridiculous, it will go away. And it doesn't. It goes to number one on the bestseller list and the Today Show and the Tonight Show. And I think, if nothing else, the fact that Coulter has been the subject of three critical books that have called people on the attention they've paid to her, it's going to make it more difficult for her to get attention the next time around.
Hmm.
Okay,
hmm.
I think when she comes out the next time around, everybody's going to feel much more nervous about giving her the kind of attention they did last time. And they're going to think, if they put her on, does that mean they have to put me on criticizing her?
Mm.
And does that mean they have to put the other guy on criticizing them for putting her on? And all of a sudden, she's become a lot more difficult to contend with. And, you know, to me, that means we've accomplished something. We've sent a message to people that says, if you go over the line here, and there still is a line, believe it or not, maybe, then there may be even consequences. You know, this girl has been standing up there insulting people, making gay jokes, making jokes at the expense of the widows of 9/11 that aren't jokes at all, that are in fact serious, vicious assaults. And because she's blonde and because she's thin, and that's why I did the cover the way I did as a sort of parody on selling looks.
Yeah, yeah. For my listeners, Susan Estrich dressed up just like Ann Coulter.
I dressed up as her. I played Halloween.
Exactly,
you know?
Like her. She looks like one of the
like
Desperate Housewives.
Saying, you know, here I am, I'm 50 years old, I can sell this too. Because the very idea of Ann Coulter is that if you dress in a black cocktail dress at 8 o'clock in the morning, you can sell almost any kind of vitriol, and people will let you say anything you want. And it's really been effective for her. And it's a real condemnation of our society that, on the one hand, this woman, you know, condemns the objectification of women and blah, blah, blah. And on the other hand, there she goes and does it. And I've never walked around in a cocktail dress at 8 in the morning, but I will tell you, people treat you different.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Susan Estrich. Now, Susan, you ask the question in this Ann Coulter book. You ask, what kind of society turns a purveyor of hate into a TV personality? So she's not the only one to blame, right? I mean, our culture has...
You know, I picked her because she, last summer there was just this moment that became a symbol, and you pick moments and symbols to try to put the focus on and the spotlight. But even she doesn't operate in a vacuum. I mean, mm-hmm. Bookers put her on TV. They make her a hero. Jay Leno has her on and doesn't ask her a single hard question. I mean, what's that about? You know, would he do that with a guy who was spewing hate about Jews? I don't think so.
Yeah.
But is spewing hate about Muslims somehow okay? I mean, I hate that set of questions.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm very troubled by where we're going as a society right now.
I was going to ask you that, because it seems to be permeating all of the airwaves, all the hate talk radio and so on.
There.
It's not just Ann Coulter.
No, it's very ugly, and it's, you know, certain groups are particularly the target, of course, and certain groups are particularly the subjects, you know,
mm-hmm.
and certain people do it and certain people get it, and it's really ugly,
mm-hmm.
and you wonder, why is it that this sells so well? And the internet has become a real breeding ground for it.
Yeah.
For a kind of ugliness.
Mm-hmm.
That
I think that's probably where it started.
There's
no censorship.
My email has certainly always.
Yeah, I mean, it's a place where people don't have to censor themselves,
the rules don't apply, and where nobody's responsible. But my argument is that precisely because there are all these impulses in those directions, there's got to be some responsibility in the media. And some responsibility among the people who apportion what is still precious time in media spaces, which is what we all have.
That's exactly why I started this show, to tell you the truth.
Well, good for you.
It'd be a forum for people to really talk and not be put down and so on, yeah.
Well, because that's what they do. And it's, you know, you have to be very courageous right now to put your head up in public debate. I mean, you really have to have guts, because the first thing that will be done to you is you'll be shot at. And you'll be shot at, called an idiot, called a fool. Your legs will be taken off. Your head will be chopped off. And it's a kind of viciousness that is enough to drive most people out.
Yeah.
And even her point about the widows was, they deserve this. They should have expected it when they raised their heads to participate after their husbands died.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she called them harpies.
Harpies,
and that
they really enjoyed their
this.
Husband's death.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, didn't they expect that level of criticism?
Mm-hmm. Now, you say Coulter's right-wing agenda is widely out of step with the American public. Now, do you think these last, the midterm elections have proven you right in regard to that?
I actually
Has her
do.
Power been lessened?
It's rare to be able to say, yes, I predicted this one, but I bet all the boys on Fox News, I just kept sitting there saying, well, I'll bet you dinner at the Palm. I just said it over and over again, and I won all these bets.
Well, so you have to take these horrible men to dinner?
No, they're supposed to take them.
You have to go with them?
Well, whether they'll ever want to collect is another question. I think they view it as, do they have to go with this horrible person, me, and listen to me spout about how I was right?
So do you think some of Ann Coulter's power has been diminished because of this election?
No, I think they're just going to go after, you know, because I don't think much is going to happen. in truth. I think they will, you know, already we're seeing the signs that they don't really accept any results, any mandate. Do you see any sign that George Bush has accepted a mandate?
Absolutely not, and it is absolutely shocking to so many people that he is so in denial.
I mean, he's not going to accept any mandate. And to be perfectly honest, what do you think the odds are that the Democrats are going to be able to do anything in Congress?
I was going to ask you about the slim
majority.
Yeah.
You know, you got a majority of Joe Lieberman in the Senate. I mean, you know, how much does that give you?
That was incredibly disturbing as well.
Okay.
So
that's your majority in the Senate. I mean, I'm delighted that all these staff people get jobs. I'm delighted that we get control of the television series, which are the hearing agendas. And, you know, that we get some power to determine the agenda and to play the politics. But in terms of getting actual control over the country, that's what a presidential election is about. So this was just the staging. Now the real battle begins. And I think this is going to be a huge, huge fight because the stakes are just enormous.
Now, you've been criticized for taking on the job of being a progressive commentator on Fox News. Why did you do that?
Well, I did it for two reasons. One reason is because I don't see that much of a difference between the television networks, to be perfectly honest.
Honest to God, really.
But the real reason is because I think Fox has an audience that is worth talking to. I mean, it would be pleasant to spend all my time talking to people who already agree with me. And that would be very nice. And then they would say, we agree with you, or maybe you're not liberal enough, and then we could all discuss how liberal we would be. But the truth is that Fox has this huge audience relative to every other cable network. I think it's larger than all the rest combined. And none of them, or very few of them, probably start out agreeing with me. But some of them, at the end of the day, will decide the election. And that is true every 2 years. And Fox has probably got more of the undecided, independent, you know, middle-of-the-road voters who actually swing every year and decide elections than CNN and MSNBC and CNBC combined.
Is that true? Because, I mean, most people think that it's the right-wing channel,
no,
right? It's Dick Cheney's favorite channel.
You can look at the numbers. I've looked at the numbers, and we're more conservative, but we're only more conservative by 8 to 10 points. We still have plenty of independents and undecideds in the middle. So, you know, given the opportunity to talk to people in the middle and talk to people who are undecided and not spend all my time preaching to the choir, which is fun, but, you know, at the end of the day, we're not going to win elections preaching to a dwindling choir or even an expanding choir.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I get paid to talk to people who might decide the election in our favor, and I think that's a useful and important thing to do. And I think what's unfortunate is that if I didn't do it, there's almost no voices over there.
You know, I realize that, and that's a good point. Yeah. Does Fox give you free rein in regard to what you can talk about?
I have total free rein in terms of what I say, and I also try to work behind the scenes. I mean, I have longstanding relationships with people there. I have a fair amount of influence in terms of things I want to accomplish. You know, when I see things that look to me off, I tell them, you know, I get to influence, you know, have some influence inside. You know, does Fox take a different approach than other networks? Yes, of course it does. I mean, I don't deny that. But within that framework, I at least want to make sure that my side of the aisle gets heard. And so I write a column twice a week on the website called Blue Streak, which is basically the Democratic view on things.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a sort of sometimes pain in the butt ski on the inside saying, excuse me, I didn't hear from so-and-so. And so from the inside, I try to make sure that within the limits of, you know, Fox taking a different kind of point of view than other cable networks, we do it in a fair way. And I have a very good relationship with most, but not all, I'll be honest enough to say,
I'm sure.
The guys inside.
Now, do you think your high-profile image and your notoriety have helped you or hindered you as a teacher? I know you still teach law.
I've been teaching a long time, mm-hmm. and I think I have a reputation as a teacher that's pretty much independent of what I do outside the classroom. So what I do outside the classroom becomes sort of an alter ego, and my kids understand it as such. My students understand it as such. I mean, I am first and foremost a professor, mm-hmm. and always have been. Mm-hmm. And the first thing I say on the first day of class is that this is not a television studio, and we're not doing television here, and, you know, nothing is on the record, and we don't do politics here, and there's no rules of political correctness in my classes, and it's a completely different atmosphere. But that's because I've been teaching for 27 years, so I don't bring my TV persona, as it were, into my classrooms. I mean, there's a lot of people who become TV stars and then they want to be a TV star in the classroom. Mm-hmm. I'm just an academic in the classroom. You know, I've been a law professor for longer than I've been a TV pundit. Mm-hmm. So I just do that. I mean, I really enjoy teaching, but that's a whole different world for me.
Oh, well, that's interesting to know. Now,
but I do hate, it probably makes my classes bigger. I have 186 kids.
I'm sure it does. You know how that fame thing is attractive to people.
Has an impact.
Exactly.
But the actual class is the same.
You're pretty traditional, huh?
Yeah.
Now, listen, I know you were the first woman to run a presidential campaign. It was Dukakis in 88. Do you think you'll get actively involved in 2008?
No, you know why? I have two teenagers.
Mm.
So the other reason I work on television is because you can work on television and then come home and be chauffeur and chaperone, which is what I do with a big chunk of my life. So I think what I will continue to do is kibitz with the various people who work in the campaigns and talk about them and cheerlead and try to help in whatever way I can. But the reality of campaigns and one of the challenges for women is that I remember looking around the Mondale campaign in 1984 when I was traveling with a candidate and realizing that we were having this whole debate about family values and there wasn't a single mother on the campaign.
Mm.
Because how could you be a mother and be on a campaign?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so the times have changed.
No, the times haven't changed. Mm. You still can't be a mother and be on a campaign.
Well, I suppose that's true. I assume Hillary got involved though when Bill was running and when Chelsea was still young. But
she was
that's
a
different story.
Yeah. That's true. But I mean, among the staff people, yeah. Among the travelers, I mean, you know, you have to work 100 hours a week, and that's reserved for fathers and single women.
So, Susan Estridge, we have run out of time. I want to thank you so much for talking to us, and good luck in the future. We look forward to some more of your commentary.
Great to talk to you, and good luck with your wonderful show.
Oh, thank you. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And log on to our new website at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.